This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Scientists have made many breakthroughs in understanding which parts of the brain control certain behaviors. But one of the great remaining mysteries is how the brain creates a sense of self, an identity. Dr. Todd Feinberg is a neurologist who's investigating this by studying patients with brain injuries or disorders that have disrupted this sense of self. For instance, a person who no longer recognizes that his arm is part of his own body, or a person who thinks his own spouse is a stranger. Dr. Feinberg describes his work in his new book, Altered Egos, How the Brain Creates the Self. He teaches at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine and is the chief of the Betty and Morton Yarman Division of Neurobehavior and Alzheimer's Disease at the Beth Israel Medical Center in New York. I asked him what he means when he says he's looking for where the sense of self is located in the brain.
Where is your subjective sense of who you are, what you are, and how you feel about yourself? So I'm trying to find the neurological underpinnings of the inner I, the self, the subjective self, the ego, the part of yourself that you feel is the most intimate aspect of your inner self.
In order to research what part of the brain might control the sense of self, you're studying people with brain injuries and brain disorders. How can studying the brain injuries and disorders help you figure this out?
By studying patients who have brain damage, we find that many areas of the brain make a contribution to the self. So I set out, this is now 15 years ago, through behavioral neurology and neuropsychiatry to determine what areas of the brain contributed to the self. And we do that by doing an analysis of a particular area of the brain is damaged. This leads to a certain disorder of the self. Another area of the brain is damaged. This leads to a different disorder of the self. Trying to put all these areas together in the brain can help us understand how diverse areas contribute to the unified self that we experience as our inner I.
And your book is filled with really fascinating case studies of people with brain disorders that really do affect their sense of self. For example, tell us the story of the woman who didn't recognize that her arm was her own arm.
This disorder is called asomatognosia, and it is actually very common. It occurs when a patient has damage to the right hemisphere of the brain, the non-dominant hemisphere. Our language is in our left hemisphere, and vast majority of right-handers and even the majority of left-handers have language in the left hemisphere. And a stroke on the left side can give you what we call aphasia, which is a disorder of language, the inability to communicate or understand what is said to you. On the other hand, a patient with a right hemisphere lesion has a different syndrome that we call hemispatial neglect. And this is where the patient ignores or fails to pay attention to the left side of space and the left side of their body sometimes. Asomatognosia is when the patient with a right hemisphere lesion disavows or denies ownership of the limb. So what we do is in a right hemisphere stroke patient, we'll take the arm, lift it up, show it to them, and ask the patient, well, what is this? And patients who have asomatognosia, as many of the cases in my book do, will misidentify that arm. They may call it a deodorant, a rusty chicken wing. They may refer to it as the doctor's arm. Some people may give it a name, like Gammy or Toby or my little monkey, and they will treat it often as an entity separate from themselves. Some patients even try to feed the arm, where they'll pick it up and pat it and sing songs to it, or treat it as if it were a child. Women typically misidentify their left arm when they have this condition as belonging to a husband. Men, interestingly enough, I have found, often will misidentify it as their mother-in-law's arm.
I want to ask what your interpretation of that is.
This is a true fact, though. I've seen this over and over again. So it's interesting.
So do you ever try to convince the patient that the arm is actually their own? And if so, what's their reaction to that?
One of the interesting things about asomatognosia, and indeed really all of the disorders that I consider in my book, are that they're refractory to correction. Patients resist the truth in these circumstances, which is why they're somewhat different from other simple neurobehavioral syndromes such as paralysis of the right arm, for example. These patients will oftentimes deny the truth of the situation in spite of being told over and over again, for instance, that that is your left arm. Look, it's connected to your shoulder. It's got your ring on it. It looks identical to the other arm. And yet, these patients will still resist the truth. And one of the perplexing problems in behavioral neurology is, why are patients so resistant to the truth? It's almost as if they're denying the truth about the left arm. And this pertains not just to asomatognosia. This pertains to another disorder that we're interested in called anosognosia, which is unawareness of the paralysis. Most of these patients have paralysis of the left arm. They have a right hemisphere stroke. They can't move their left arm. And not only do they misidentify it, but they may claim that the arm is as strong as the normal arm, that there's been no change in its function, and that it can move quite normally. And those two conditions, anosognosia and asomatognosia, often go together.
Let's look at another brain disorder that creates a pathology in the sense of self. And this is one that's called delusional misidentification syndrome, where a person thinks that their family or their friends have been replaced by imposters. What's an example of that?
There's a common delusional misidentification syndrome known as Capgras syndrome. And this is one that actually I'm sure many of your listeners have either heard of or may have even had a loved one experience, because it is actually rather common, and it occurs in, for instance, Alzheimer's disease and other dementias. And this is where an individual of the patients, particularly a spouse or child, is claimed to be an imposter. So, for instance, the common scenario is, this is a patient who, by the way, is psychiatrically not had problems previously, but develops a brain disease. And you can see this in psychiatric conditions, but in neurological cases, these are patients who have no delusional thinking prior to the development of a brain disease. And they'll walk in and they'll say, this is not my wife. This is an imposter. I don't know where my wife is, but this is not her. This is not the original. This is not the one that I know. This is not the one that I'm related to. This is not the original. The original is somewhere else, and this is a double. And that's called the Capgras syndrome, and we see this quite commonly in the neuropsychiatric clinic. It is a denial of the identity of a person, particularly someone close to you. So it's a daughter, a spouse, a brother, someone that the patient has a lot of interaction with. And when this presents, it's often in the early stages of brain disease, so that the patient in other respects is actually quite normal. They just have this one particular delusional misidentification syndrome.
Now, you're studying these disorders of the self to help you understand what part of the brain or what parts of the brain help create the sense of self. What clue does this disorder give you?
Well, one interesting aspect of the Capgras syndrome, and there's the related syndrome, the Fregoli syndrome, which is where the patient will claim that a stranger is actually somebody that they know, the opposite scenario, is that the right hemisphere plays an important role in these particular syndromes. Patients with right hemisphere damage, be it stroke or atrophy of one hemisphere or a brain injury from a car accident, oftentimes have damage to the right hemisphere, again implicating the importance of the right hemisphere, the non-dominant hemisphere, in establishing relatedness and the sense of self and who you are. So that points us in a direction of localization, that there appears to be a dominance for that hemisphere, for the right hemisphere, in self-awareness and the subjective self of who we are and how we're related to people in the world. So that's another clue that that's an important part of the brain that contributes to the self.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Dr. Todd Feinberg, and he's the head of the Division of Neurobehavior and Alzheimer's Disease at the Beth Israel Medical Center in New York. He's written a new book called Altered Egos, How the Brain Creates the Self. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. My guest is neurologist Dr. Todd Feinberg, and he's the head of neurobehavior and Alzheimer's disease at the Beth Israel Medical Center in New York. His new book is called Altered Egos, How the Brain Creates the Self. Let's talk about another disorder of the self, the alien hand syndrome. Tell us about that.
The alien hand syndrome is really one of the most interesting disorders that we come across. What happens is if a patient has damage to a structure called the corpus callosum, which is this massive fiber bundle that connects the left and right hemisphere and coordinates the actions of the two hemispheres, if that structure is damaged, cut either surgically or by tumor or by stroke, one hand may not know what the other hand is doing. And there are circumstances where, in particular, if it's only the corpus callosum that is damaged, the left hand escapes the patient's conscious, willful intentions. And that left hand may grab cups and throw them across the room, and the patient has no sense of purpose about doing any of these things. The hand actually may attack the patient. So one of my patients repeatedly woke up at night with the hand around his throat, and that's not uncommon. Self-strangling of the left hand occurs. Another patient's hand would grope along his leg, rip off his pajamas, and with the left hand, the right hand had to grab it, wrestle it to the floor, and this kind of intermanual conflict can occur, especially early on when the corpus callosum is divided. Why this is interesting is because what it tells us about unity, about brain unity, what it tells us is that indeed there is no consciousness or mind that does not require cerebral integration. If you destroy the corpus callosum, there are times at which the brain can act as if it possessed two minds, two independent entities. So anatomical integrity is critical to mental unity. On the other hand, there's another interesting aspect to this problem, which is that alien hand is rare. Most patients who have damage to the corpus callosum alone don't get it. And if they do get it, it resolves rather rapidly.
It's amazing how so many of these disorders that you're describing have echoes in horror movies.
Yeah. Well, the left alien hand, or the alien hand, is sometimes called the Dr. Strangelove effect, from the movie where Peter Sellers has an arm that repeatedly... The character that Peter Sellers plays repeatedly tries to make a Nazi salute, and the other arm has to wrestle it down. And indeed, many of these disorders, I wouldn't say restricted to horror movies. I think that the literary and cinematic themes frequently draw from these neurobehavioral syndromes. And when you become aware of them, it's extraordinary how commonly you'll see doubles represented or Capgras syndrome represented. I mean, the invasion of the body snatchers is classic delusional misidentification syndrome and all their variants. I point out that the Wizard of Oz is probably the most well-known Fugoli syndrome ever reported, where the Tin Man, the Lion, and the Scarecrow are actually, they have other identities, the farmhands from Kansas, inserted into their beings. This is a Fregoli syndrome par excellence. So if one becomes aware of these things, you'd be amazed at how widely they ramify in cultural themes and in personal dreams.
Well, it sounds as if there are various parts of the brain that work together in creating a sense of self. It's not like you're going to find one part that handles it.
Well, that's my opinion. I mean, I just had a very lively debate with somebody in a meeting in Florida about that. But in my opinion, I have great difficulty excluding virtually any area as making a contribution to the self. There, I find more areas that make a contribution to the self than those that don't. And I would include the frontal lobes, the left hemisphere, the right hemisphere, all these areas of the brain, or at least many of these areas of the brain, make a contribution to the self. And the real puzzle then becomes, we see, we'd like to take a finger or a probe and point and say, Eureka, there it is. I've got it. There is the self. All I need to do is take this area and image it, and I'll image the neurological basis of this person's self. But it's not that easy. There are so many areas that contribute to the self. The real perplexing puzzle, the mystery, is how do these areas all combine? How are they all put together to create the seamless inner I that we all experience as I?
Say you actually succeeded in figuring out a model for how the brain creates a sense of self.
Mm-hmm.
Where would that leave us? What would we be able to do or understand that we can't do or understand now?
Well, to be perfectly honest, most of this work is done for the love of the work. It's done simply to get a better understanding of who we are.
What it means to be human.
What it means to be human. And, I mean, I recall, I'd say probably the age of 7 or 8, and becoming aware that I had thoughts that didn't seem to be anywhere. And I started to think, well, where is my mind? I mean, I know I have this brain inside my head, but I could point to my brain, but where's my mind? How does this material object, how does this brain produce the mind? And ultimately, in my training and practice as a neurologist and a psychiatrist, which is really quite aside from the more neurophilosophical implications of the work that I do, I became fascinated by these patients who had these disorders of the self. So it's really simply an intellectual pursuit, a greater understanding of what it means to be a human being, what it means to have a mind, what it means to have a self. Now, I do believe that actually, if I'm correct as to what's going on here, I believe it does have important implications for the neuroscience and understanding how the brain is combined and organized.
You know, I'm thinking when someone takes their loved one to you, the doctor, mm-hmm. and their loved one has one of these brain disorders in which their mm-hmm. sense of self is broken in some fundamental way, the people in the family must be just horrified and upset about this really disturbing phenomenon. Whereas for you, it's in part just absolutely fascinating because it's mm-hmm. it's leading you to all these larger observations about the brain and the sense of self.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure what my question is, but I guess you must be operating on a really different level than the really worried family is. And is that ever of any consolation to them? That
what we try to do is help the family understand what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
I'll explain the phenomenon, relieve them of their guilt, help them to cope with the circumstances from an emotional standpoint, which is a big part of the therapy. And at the same time, we're trying to cure with medication, counseling, the patient's problem in the first place. Most of these conditions, we have an approach to treatment, be it medication, psychotherapy, family counseling. You'd be amazed at how much we're able to improve the patient's life, the family's ability to deal with that patient, and avoid a lot of conflict within the family by explaining to them what's happening here, why this is going on, that this is not the patient's fault, this is not your fault, this is what the brain does, this is how the brain adapts. In the meantime, we're trying to cure them. And indeed, many of these conditions can be treated.
What's one of the most amazing breakthroughs in the treatment of brain disorders that have developed during the time that you've been practicing medicine?
Well, for me, probably the most important development has been the memory medications that we have. When I started my practice back in 86, 87, we had no medications at all. Now we have several that are available to treat memory disorders, and we've seen that kind of advance. It's not a cure, but it helps the disorder. And also our greater understanding of Alzheimer's disease and its neurobiology, we're hopeful that in the next couple of years we're going to really have some big breakthroughs. So we're waiting for those. And I would say that our understanding of that condition has just exploded over the last 10 years. And I think our understanding of the brain in general has been seen enormous advances from when it was when I was back in medical school, for instance.
Well, Dr. Feinberg, thank you so much for sharing some of your work with us.
Okay.
Dr. Todd Feinberg is the author of the new book, Altered Egos, How the Brain Creates the Sense of Self. He's chief of the Division of Neurobehavior and Alzheimer's Disease at the Beth Israel Medical Center in New York. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.